are back with episode 406 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and something just jumped out at me in the show notes. We all know Babylon 5. We spent many wonderful hours with Babylon 5. Babylon 5 has made a difference in all of our lives. Helix, you're no Babylon 5.
Ooh, throwing down the gauntlet already. And Bronze Thumb.
Bronze Thumb is going to humbly bow before Edmund's very, very accurate call on Helix. Yeah. I'm not going to top that.
Oh, we'll probably get into it or not, as the case may be. As usual, our new rules apply, and hopefully everyone out there has been listening and knows that we're changing things up still and ongoing. So there you are. And hey, yeah, this is knee-deep in the Olympics. We're about halfway through that, so a lot of shows that were really dominating the airwaves just stopped doing so. Without warning, still, we have about 2 weeks' worth of material to get through, so I think we probably shouldn't have too much of a preamble here. So, Edmund, why don't you give a disclaimer so we can jump into something?
Absolutely. We will tell you exactly why we love or hate these shows we've been watching, so we have to warn you that you will be horribly spoiled. But especially with this Olympic dearth of programming, we've left a bit of time before we're actually talking about them, so we hope you've had time to catch up.
That's right, and it helps that I was also on my own little world tour here, not quite going through the Winter Olympics, but given some of the travel conditions, it felt like it. Anyhow, let's see, Edmund, why don't we go ahead and start with you, and are you going to throw us a bit of a curveball, or are you going to start where you already started?
No, I think we should save that for later, and since we're returning after a break, I think we should pick up with The Walking Dead's return.
Okay, sounds good, and here's the promo.
I wanna clung to that for you. We'll never get things back to the way they used to be.
I'm afraid of nothing.
Find a safe place soon. We will.
You gotta stay who you are. Not who you were.
And if you could do the recap for us, please.
Absolutely. This is The Walking Dead, Season 4, Episode 9, After. Rick deals with old wounds while members of the prison try to accept their new environment. Or at least those members of the prison we actually catch up with.
That's right. Okay, well, before we get started with the actual discussion, let's go ahead and, as is our new policy, give our scores. Now, for everyone out there who may not realize why we're doing this, number one, it helps us focus in on the shows that we actually want to dig into rather than move past as fast as possible. But it also means that we're not really influencing each other in changing our impressions, as there are some people who believe that we have a tendency to kind of align with each other after a while. So we're going to try and hit these unvarnished opinions right off the bat. So Edmund, what would you give this one, do you think?
I thought it was a very strong return. I will give it a 9.
Ooh-hoo. And Bronstein, how about you?
I also gave it a 9.
All right. And I would give it the same. So clearly this is a good one to start with. So Edmund, why don't you go ahead and start us off? What did you love about this episode?
Well, certainly the way they were taking advantage of that big climactic battle and everybody getting thrown asunder to really throw a curveball. And certainly having this first episode focusing on Rick and Carl trying to make their way, rather haltingly and limpingly in Rick's case, really worked well, and also was a wonderful showcase, obviously, for Chandler Riggs. I mean, he was having to carry a lot of the load this episode, both in terms of the story and in terms of the acting load, and I thought that this was a real coming-of-age saga, both for the character and for the actor. And the... And it was kind of hitting on some of the strong suits from earlier seasons, both the getting back to some of the feeling from the very first season when when Rick's literally first on the road and trying to figure out what's going on, and this being reversed a bit now with Rick being the one injured and maybe on his last legs. And also going back to last season when we had the wonderful episode where they're all on the road trip, and again, of course, it was Rick and Carl and Michonne, running into Lenny James, and I'm sorry, the character name is escaping me, but again, having that smaller focus on just a few characters and really honing in on how people are dealing with and adjusting to the apocalypse, and it just worked really well to, and you know, and as they've been doing, I mean, there's been the ongoing tension between, is it a character study, is it a zombie drama? We certainly still had the good Carl on zombie action and Carl getting piled on by zombies, and yeah, I mean, it was. I thought it did a really good job of resetting things and setting itself up on a new interesting direction. And certainly that journey Carl goes through from being very much the petulant teenager, why do I need you? I can be on my own, to coming to that realization of that no, he's not quite ready. He can't do that. And having that then segue into Michonne finding them after her own journey through virtually becoming a walker herself and coming out of it, and of course another brilliant zombie massacre. It was just a very, very nice mix of the things that work for the show. But enough of me babbling on. What do you guys think?
Bronstein, well, anything to add to that?
Just that it very much felt like a throwback to sort of the first and second seasons, where the character drama was so much more the focus, and it just happened to be set in a zombie apocalypse, and the walkers were a way of advancing the plot and sort of setting up the trials and tribulations that the characters had to go through. I mean, I've really enjoyed season four thus far. I thought it's done a great job of balancing that character drama aspect that has made that made the show so strong in the beginning, and that made the original comic books so strong, with the kind of zombie action vibe that a lot of the more casual viewers or people who have sort of come into the show expecting. But yeah, this episode was much more of a throwback. It developed some of the characters who haven't necessarily had as much development in that sense, and just showed us some really, really interesting things about what this situation does to people. And Carl in particular, I think, has never been as much the focus as he's in this episode. And I've seen the debates. I think John on Facebook, you brought it up for a little bit, just the notion of Carl's behavior in this episode is really, it's just so, like, he's such a teenager. Like, this is the first time in ages that we've really seen him acting his age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all, like, perfectly consistent with the way that teenagers behave. They want independence. They want to prove that they are smart enough and mature enough and wise enough to sort of make it on their own, regardless of whether they actually are smart or wise or mature enough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of aspect, that teenagerness of Carl, that it's been suppressed a long time, because in the third season and the first part of the fourth season especially, he really has been, he's not just been treated like an adult, he's at times been treated like a leader. The episode from the third season where Tyrese and his group showed up at the prison is one that really sticks out in my mind, because it was Carl who found them, it was Carl who led them to safety, and Tyrese just immediately starts treating Carl the way that everyone else treats Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And justifiably so. So this episode is this very typical teenager mentality, butting heads with a situation that's very unique to a zombie apocalypse setting, which is that young people are expected to be so much more mature and adult than they really have any right to be, than anyone really has a right to expect of them. And I thought it played out brilliantly. I thought that the actor got a chance to stretch his acting muscles in a way that we haven't seen for a really long time. Not because he's been bad, but because he's not had this much material. And yeah, it just played out fantastically.
Yeah, it occurred to me, especially afterward, that a lot of people either were forgetting that he is a teenager, that and exactly how much he's had to go through, and that for all intent purposes, I mean, this, even though he rails against it to a certain extent in this episode, he's actually been able to find some sense of stability within the prison. I mean, they've been there how long? It's been there kind of like a return to civilization to some degree. And this is really the second or third time that he's lost a sense of home. And they're starting from scratch yet again. And because his father is in such rough shape, he's really once again being asked to shoulder a lot of the burden. And he finally just cracks to a certain extent. And he lashes out as teenagers will do. And I think that people just kind of were not giving him the degree of understanding who he is that really they should have. I don't know what they were expecting of the character, but I mean, there were a lot of harsh comments about Carl after this episode, and I really felt that they were completely unjustified. This is not the same Carl that was at the beginning of the series.
there's a really strong temptation to just make the old season 2 joke of just stay in the house, Carl. But you can't make that as a serious criticism though, because this is no longer the writers using Carl's wandering off or whatnot as a way of generating story. I mean, this is the story. This is a perfectly legitimate thing for him to do, perfectly in keeping with his character, and it played out exactly as it should have. I can't imagine him sort of chucking a hissy fit, for lack of a better word, for any better reason, or it going any other way than it did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, also, it's the fact that, you know, that he, yes, he's not perfect at it, but he does go out there and get food and manage to keep himself from getting killed. And it is him doing it, not somebody coming in and rescuing him. So yeah, I thought it was very good at building up that sense of why he would start feeling like, no, I can get by on my own. I don't need you, and you've screwed up all these things. And but then at the same time, did a good job of coming around to, in the end, no, he can't face the prospect of the Rick has turned, and he's going to have to shoot him and would rather just join him. But I think we're also, of course, we're also, that part was so powerful. I think we're also overlooking that all that backstory we're getting on Michonne as well, which was nice to finally see. Cause even though I'd been avoiding the comics, you know, I had gotten enough background to where, yes, I did know who her two pets were at the beginning of the show, but it was nice to finally get the background on her brother and her lover, and also just to see the rather jarring beginnings. That was certainly an interesting choice, and so I think that's just about the first time since the beginning of the series we've actually seen life before the apocalypse. And that just worked really well to contrast that with then her moving along with her two new pets, and until she reaches that point of, no, I'm not going to give in. It's time to start moving again and go back and follow the tracks, not walk away from them thinking I can just pick up where I left off. So it was a nice job of on both of those plot threads were then working back to each other. Showing some pretty sizable journeys in just an hour long episode.
Yeah,
yeah. I was just gonna say it's a story that there's not a lot of dialogue. And what dialogue we do get is comes from this really abstract place of her flashbacks, which quickly become weird dreams. And that in itself is just very, very amazing, because we really understand the arc that Michonne goes through in this episode, the way that she really falls back on the way that she was before she met the prison group, and sort of comes to this realization that she's evolved beyond that like surviving. My comment in the review is that surviving has come to mean something more than just still being alive. And if there was ever a time to do a title drop, that would be it. Because in the comics, Rick had this really appropriate title drop, pointing out the fact that The Walking Dead is not a reference to the zombies; it's a reference to the people who are still alive in the midst of it, that are just surviving and kind of waiting to die. And never would it have been more appropriate to make that reference than with Michonne's storyline. But they really didn't need to do a title drop, because that would have ruined the dialogue lacking. I don't know, sense of that whole storyline that was just fantastic. The use the visuals and the symbolism, the way that she crosses the road but then comes back later, the seeing the zombie that looks like her killing her pets in the end to sort of like reject this thing of like, you know, camouflage is not good enough. I'm not going to just become one of them. It did so much based on performance and visual, and yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, it invoked the title drop without having to actually state it, because visually it was saying everything that it needed to. And I think that's what I liked about it as well, is that it was such a visually lyrical episode. I know that there are people that get a little bit tired of the slow pacing that this show can sometimes have, but quite frankly, this is the thing that drew me to the show in the first place, and what you and Edmund had been saying since the very beginning, is that it's not about the zombie apocalyptic action, it's about the characters and what they're going through. And a lot of the time, they rely on the actors to communicate that through body language, not through dialogue. And it's better that way, in my opinion. Clearly, as we all gave this a 9, I think we all agree on that. So I think, you know, we've probably kind of said enough just to point out that this second half of the fourth season started off really strong, and it only focused on 3 characters. There's still a lot more revelation to come, and it's probably going to be equally grueling, if not worse. Because that's how things work. All right. That being said, then, Bronstom, you get to decide what we talk about next.
Well, one that I think we've all been waiting for a while, not just to talk about, but to actually watch, I think, is the Sherlock series finale, series 3 finale.
Okay, sounds good to me. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
I see the bad moon arising.
I've dealt with murderers, psychopaths, terrorist serial killers.
I see trouble on
me. None of them can turn my stomach like Charles Augustus Magnuson.
The hell have you done?
I see.
Deal the devil. Moon
horizon. You go against Magnuson, and you will find yourself going against me.
Sherlock Holmes has made one enormous mistake, which will destroy the lives of everyone he loves.
Why did you ever feel pain?
Oh, Sherlock, what have you done?
Sherlock continues on BBC One and catch up on BBC iPlayer.
All right, and Bronstone, if you could do the honors of the recap.
Okay, well, this is Sherlock, Series 3, Episode 3, His Last Vow. A case of stolen letters leads Holmes into conflict with a master blackmailer who knows the personal weaknesses of every important person in the Western world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what would you give this one, do you think?
I am absurdly happy to just hike this up to 10 out of 10. This was awesome.
Okay, Edmund?
Yeah, I will go 10 as well. It was between 9 and 10, and yes, I will go 10.
Interesting. I'm going to probably shock the two of you saying I'm going with an 8. Lowest scored of the 3 for me. I guess I'll go ahead and start off then, since you guys think it was about as good as it could get. My frustrations with this one center almost entirely upon the reveal about Mary and everything that came out of that. I felt like, and I really do not know if it was trying to invoke something from the original canon somehow, but I doubt it. It just felt to me like it was almost unnecessary. Because really, to me, what the thrust of this one was, and it was a lot more interesting this way, was the whole Mycroft and Holmes and Sherlock kind of battling it out, while you have this other nemesis out there, and learning essentially that even though he wasn't really quote unquote present in the previous two episodes, that he actually was involved in it quite a bit, that he kind of brings all of the action of these three episodes of this third season together. But to me, then, this whole thing with Mary felt almost extraneous, a bit forced, and it just felt like to me, like, I don't know, they didn't need to do that in order to make the trio that they had already been setting up in the first two episodes just as potent a force to reckon with in the fourth series as it's going to be. I don't know. It just, it didn't ring as true as I think they wanted it to, at least for me. I think you guys probably disagree with me, so one of you tell me why.
Well, the I'm trying to think of it. The in terms of like references to the canon, there was very like the way that they played Mary had little to do with the Mary as she appears in the canon, although she fulfills a role in this episode that was filled by someone in the canon story that Charles Augustus Magnuson is based on. But I thought the reveal worked. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And the reason is because for the first time since A Study in Pink, they had really gotten back to that characterization of John Watson that really engaged me, and that I thought was just insanely interesting and fun and cool to play around with, which was that notion that he is this danger addict, that he has this predilection for violence and you know, dangerous situations and all that kind of thing. They really played that up in the first episode, and I thought it was so interesting because normally adaptations of Sherlock Holmes they play out more how messed up Holmes is, and this one did the same thing, but then it also played up on how messed up Watson would have to be to just put up with it all from Holmes. And it did something really interesting, and this episode got back to that immediately. Like in the first 10-15 minutes, they just really brought that characterization back in awesome ways. Just the way he charges off into danger at the first opportunity, tire iron in his pants, beating the tar out of the junkie whose name I'm forgetting. So quickly and brutally it was just a really good reminder of where the character came from and how they planned to, you know, how they originally sort of set him up in Study in Pink. So therefore, the way that they played out the reveal of Mary just fell completely into that. The notion that that she does have this danger in that this dangerous aspect, this secretive aspect and whatnot. And even though it was a subconscious thing, that's what that's what drew John to her.
Well, and I think also drew her to John as well, I think.
Yes. It was such a great it was just such a great way to bring the characterization back and do something very new and very different with the character of Mary. And while I did think that she was I did think that she was a great enough character when she was first introduced. She was this great force with, you know, a good addition to the main cast even before we knew this. So therefore, the reveal was that much more shocking. But it sort of helped in the end reinforce how much I did like her, because this was a new aspect of the character that I already liked, and it was a new aspect that I liked. It didn't reinvent her. It didn't feel like, oh, what a twist. It felt like a new aspect, and both the characters I originally knew her and this new aspect were both I both really, really enjoyed, and therefore I think the whole thing really, really worked.
where I see that, to me, it felt more like they were trying to pull the twist. And that aspect of it. And therefore, even though I agree with what they were doing with Watson, I felt like it was all getting in the way a bit of the larger story. But again,
I'm really more with Bronze Thumb on this because I didn't see it as them trying to twist. I mean, in terms of some of the reveals of the backstory, sure. I mean, that was what the blackmail was hinging on. But to my mind, it was more fleshing out and making you realize why, for instance, at the beginning, she so easily accepted Holmes and was sitting there almost amused by what was going on, as opposed to being shocked or outraged. And certainly I did also love the bringing back the Watson as Danger Man, and given what we saw of their work life, that it did make much more sense for them to be together if she was that person, really, rather than just some receptionist for his small medical practice. That part I really liked, and I also really liked the way they did the reveal of it's not a dummy of Holmes. He might feel like a dummy right now, but it's Watson sitting there having just heard all of that. So
that was great because it called back something I was trying to say before just finally crystallizes is the other character from the canon that she's supposed to be is that she is the Sherlock version of Sebastian Moran at the same time as she is the Sherlock version of Mary Morstan, because it's just so they didn't have Sebastian Moran in the empty hearse. They had all of the stuff from the empty house story and they put it in here. The sting, the dummy, all of that kind of thing. It's just that they twisted it all in a great way. They did a ton of stuff like that in this episode of just like bits from different canon adventures, you know, blended together and twisted and turned into something new and interesting and really just cool. Something that I really dug the whole way through.
I'm wondering whether or not, well, I would imagine that they did know that they were planning to continue.
I would hope so.
They hadn't been officially commissioned. Okay. Like when they were making series 2, they had already been picked up for series 3,
right.
But they didn't advertise that until after the last episode had aired, because they basically wanted to mess with people. Like anyone who knew anything about the Holmes canon knew what was probably going to happen in an episode called The Reichenbach Fall.
Yeah.
And therefore kind of underplayed it as, well, we don't know if we're coming back.
Yeah, all these scheduling problems, etc.
Yeah,
so to kind of make you think that, well, maybe they were killing off Holmes for real. This time around, they didn't have a series 4 pickup when they made the series, but Moffat and Gatiss had basically been playing. We want to come back. We want to continue doing it, and they set up to very specifically to keep going, and just sort of hope for the pickup.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they were told at some point that they weren't going to, if they kind of structured it, because I could easily see them cutting off the last little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And it being the end. But that was my kind of thing. Like, okay, did they hedge their bets a little bit there? So the reveal, apparently, and I would say it's not nearly as obvious as it seems to be, that Moriarty is out there. Although this could easily be something that he set up before his death to kind of plague the world afterwards. But what do you think? Which way?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I genuinely have no idea. I'm so interested to find out. I don't feel cheated. I don't feel like it's a cop-out, because the way that they presented it, it could go all kinds of different ways. And what's more, despite sort of the way they fiddled around with the explanation of how Sherlock survived at the beginning of Series 3, I have faith in Moffat and Gatiss to give this puzzle an interesting conclusion, an interesting answer.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, I must admit, one thing that I felt did get planted in my head during all those pseudo explanations at the beginning of the series was, I think there was just a flash of that possibility. Other than the shipping Moriarty and Holmes segment, but where they were just implanting that idea that yes, he did appear to shoot himself, but Sherlock was kind of caught up in doing all his other rigmarole. Do we really know if his body was still behind him when he fell off that roof or not?
Yeah, exactly, right? All right, well, one thing that we can say for sure is that this puts Sherlock, Series 3, at the top of the heap, so to speak, for the season. It's a little easy when you kind of have only three... scores to work with, and it's something like Sherlock where it just
Hannibal
out of the park.
Yeah,
that's true. And certainly Hannibal last season was way up there. We still got shows like Person of Interest that, you know, they're testing the waters. But we've now have a show that came in at a solid 9. And this is a good chunk above Series 2 and a full point above Series 1. So Sherlock continues to improve, even if I personally wasn't as happy with the third episode as my compatriots here, but there we are. All right, we're going to take a quick break for the middle of the show, and then we'll be back with Edmund's Next Choice, so stay tuned. All right, and Edmund, what are you going to give us this time?
Yes, well, I guess I do need to follow up on that opening, so let's talk about Helix.
Okay, let's see how much we're going to talk about Helix first. Well, let's go ahead and run. There's two episodes here, so we're going to run the promo for the first right now.
Oh, my God.
This Friday on Helix.
This wasn't a goddamn accident!
We have to go back!
It's too late!
You have no idea what's going on here!
Are we even gonna make it out of this place alive?
Right now, I'm thinking the virus is not our biggest problem.
Helix, all new this Friday at 10, only on Sci-Fi.
All right, Nedmund, if you could.
This is Helix Season 1, Episode 5, The White Room. Members of the CDC team come to the realization that nobody is who they seem to be at the base. What may surprise you is that despite what I said in the opening, which was reference to the fact that they were basically paraphrasing Jakar from Babylon 5 in that description, but this particular episode, I actually would still give a 7.
Okay. And Bronstam, how about you?
I'd also give it a 7.
Okay. And that's kind of been my default all this time. So, that's dead average, which is actually a pretty good accomplishment for this show, to be perfectly honest. Anything to say really about it, or do we kind of just move on from there? Because, I mean, it is an average episode.
The main thing that brought it up to a 7 for me was having our genius lead scientist actually show a little intelligence in terms of immediately knowing that Doreen was not the victim of a hideous accident. So we didn't have to play out this, you know, some absurd, you know, oh, this just happened. And, you know, he realized immediately that she was killed and who killed her. I did really like the way they up the ante with all this talk of the White Room, and then eventually coming out that no, the White Room is of course just out on the snow, and we got to have some fun action with disembodied heads rising out of the tundra and attacks of ice axes, and actually using their setting for some good suspense, and you would think some very effective taking out of the opposition.
Well, you'd think. Besides the fact that this is apparently a prequel to Futurama, we could only wish. They kind of continued along, and this, of course, will apply to the following episode or the next one that we'll discuss as well. But, you know, we've got more of this stuff that Hitaki is, number one, he's coming up with a quote-unquote universal cure, which, based on some of his decisions, I would say he's not only found it, but he may, in fact, have it in his system already. But then we have this virus has gone quote unquote out of control that he claims he has no idea what's going on with, but that seems fairly unlikely. And its ability to change up its vectors makes it seem very weaponized to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It seems like they're slowly but surely getting somewhere with this. It's also like they're flailing along until they feel like they can actually do a reveal, which, not unlike the hallucinating, now I may be mixing episodes here, so forgive me, but was this the one where we actually found out about the doctor down in the quarantine area, or was that the next episode?
No, it was this episode.
This is where they revealed the incredibly obvious thing that she was hallucinating just about everything that she was experiencing.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's like, that was, I'm sure, supposed to be shocking. Mm-hmm. It wasn't at all. Yeah. Similarly, I'm waiting for them to just get around to saying that Hitaki is not just creating a cure for everything, but that he's creating the virus that the cure will be needed for, and that this is all for nefarious purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems fairly obvious to me. But anyway, that becomes a lot more clear in the next episode, and I guess we might as well just go ahead and move on to that. So here's that second promo.
On the next Helix.
Just give me a little more time, Peter.
Let's do this.
How does she die, Sarah?
Morphine.
You administer the dose.
Do you enjoy watching people suffer?
My job is to save people.
Oh my God.
You use my brother as a lab rat. You put this place here so you can play God with people's lives.
Helix. New episode Friday at 10, exclusively on Showcase.
And Edmund, if you could go ahead with this as well.
Yes, and this is season 1, episode 6. Of course you left me this one. Anikatiga. Alan and Jordan make progress in decoding the virus. Hitaki secretly cures Walker before the corporation's black helicopters land on the base. They landed at the end of the last episode, but anyway. Of course, bring us Jerry Ryan as the head of the corporation.
I think you're actually an episode ahead there.
I am?
Sorry. Yeah. Ah. She didn't show up until the following episode, which we're not talking about quite yet.
Well, that's right. Okay.
So what would you give?
This
is the one where we have the local law enforcement show up out of nowhere.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. My bad. Blame the Olympics. I would give this 6.
Okay. And Bronstam? Okay, well, we'll get to him in a moment. I would also
Brunstam is here. Brunstam is having mic troubles. However, Brunstam has not had the opportunity to watch this episode yet, unfortunately. or fortunately, by the sounds of it.
Okay, well, we'll leave that alone then. All right, well, Edmund, just briefly, why would you give this a 6 versus the average 7 for the previous one?
Because this felt like they were kind of treading water a little bit again. Other than just the absurdity that we alluded to of, the man who was ice-axed and then left on the tundra, where I believe you have very few minutes before you're basically going to be dead or at least losing limbs, dragged off the ice and off to the local law enforcement, as you reminded me, was quite silly. Even if they have had her throw out the "oh, you're lucky you still have 10 fingers and toes" line, just to try and paper that over. This was kind of back to setting people up, sitting in rooms, and giving us exposition dumps of new stuff that they wanted to introduce. And it just felt like things were getting very, very static again when we were making at least some progress and getting some dynamic action and that sort of thing in the previous episode. And then this was a step back to feeling frozen in the tundra again.
Yeah, I'm going to say very much different than, say, a Walking Dead or Sherlock, that this is not a show that can just kind of carry forward on the merits of the character interactions, because the characters are so paper thin right now and indistinct that I really don't care. I just don't about a lot of what's going on, and that's probably not good. Hitaki's stuff is a lot more interesting, and I guess, you know, on the whole, I find the science fiction aspect of all this very interesting. This hint that now what's going on at the base is kind of corporate driven, that comes in this episode, and I'm assuming is going to be where Jerry Ryan's character comes in the following episode, which I haven't seen yet, which is another reason I wanted to stop you from talking.
Yes. But, yes, absolutely.
but again, this all leads to this whole idea that this has been an ongoing, for decades now, research facility that has been kind of preying on the local population, which in the Arctic, there's not much of what one would call a local population. Which, by the way, if you are the one and only effective law enforcement officer in the I'm guessing, extreme northern reaches of Canada, maybe letting the guy that you have handcuffed to your futon, who you've considered to be a major threat, know that there's no one else with authority within 3+ hours, might be, you might want to keep that to yourself. Just thinking, because it was like something she just dropped out there, and I was like, and why would you do that? Also, I find it very interesting that they find a relatively attractive young woman to be the only law enforcement officer in the wilds of northern Canada. Just saying. But anyhow, it just seemed like, again, they're reaching towards this very interesting idea, very Andromeda Strain-esque idea of kind of a rogue corporate military, you know, alliance somewhere, driving this research in order to create biological weapons and the inevitable means of surviving the viral holocaust, and the hint that the cure does not necessarily leave you in the same state that you began is also another interesting aspect of this that I'm sure they're going to play on soon enough. But it's like, I feel like I'm way ahead of the writers on this one. Way ahead of the writers. And that's not good.
Yeah. Actually, when you mentioned paper thin characters, it suddenly occurred to me that, even though the fact you have a female law enforcement officer and there are some other more modern trappings like that, it made me realize that one of the problems is that as far as the characterizations, it feels like we're stuck back in like golden age 40s and 50s science fiction, where men were men and scientists were scientists, and everything was all about just presenting the ideas, and the characters were completely interchangeable, and this is really starting to feel like a modern day version of that, and we have moved way beyond that. So.
Yes, as you say, this is no Babylon 5, that's for sure. Yeah. I'm sticking with it for the interesting ideas, but they're going to have to really move on some of this stuff. And at this point, I mean, this is one of those odd instances where we've noted that sci-fi has really knocked it out of the park in recent years in terms of bringing on shows with different ideas and making them work, at least after a few episodes, to get their feet on the ground. Defiance being the most recent example of a show that started off a little rough and then wound up really gaining ground.
Mm-hmm.
This show is a hot mess. And it's from Ron Moore. I mean, you'd think that this would be almost a slam dunk, but it feels like all the things that were the worst about Battlestar Galactica's reboot have all been amped up to 11 in this show.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's most disappointing to me. Now, granted, they could pull off a lot. They're only halfway through their first season, from what I know, but I'm not very hopeful. It's not really gained momentum. It's well below average right now. It's, you know, around a 6.5, so it's got a lot of ground to make up if it wants to hit the next level.
Yeah, definitely. Although just for sheer weirdness, and it was a lot of fun given the lack of stuff happening elsewhere in the episode. The and if I have the episodes right, I believe I do. The hallucination dinner scene was definitely a lot of fun.
Yes, that was in this one, and I did enjoy that part, but it wasn't enough to really make up for all
the
nonsense.
No. It was just nice to get away from people talking in a room.
Yes, it was just talking in a different room, but there we are.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to better material, hopefully, and Bronze Thumb. Let's go ahead and get your next choice as the topic to round out this episode.
All right, well, something that I've been keen to have a chinwag about is the latest Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
We didn't. Ha! Yes, good choice. All right, let's run the promo while my brain... This is how long the list is, folks. I started going down saying, we don't have one of those, and yet here it is. Okay, promo.
On the next Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
We're going in undercover.
I hate undercover.
A covert mission.
Let me get that.
Thanks, Dad.
Becomes a high-speed adventure.
Call for the answer!
With a very special Marvel guest star and an astonishing, series-changing final act.
Okay, hang on. Just hang on.
Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Every Tuesday at 8, 7 Central with new episodes returning February 4th. And see full episodes anytime on Watch ABC or ABC On Demand.
All right, and if you could do the recap for us.
I surely could. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 1, Episode 13, Tracks. A mysterious train proves dangerous for Agent Coulson and the team as they pursue the Clairvoyant.
All right, and I believe that you gave this one a 9 out of 10 in your review?
Indeed I did.
Edmund, how about you? What would you give this one, if you can remember back that far?
Yes, no, I can. I did enjoy it, but I think I would go with an 8.
Okay, and, oh man, I'm in between, but I'm leaning more towards the 8 this time. Even though I do feel the need to chide you about all that time we wasted and all the prostitutes and everything else, but anyway, Bronze Thumb, if you could tell us what kicked this up to a 9? We've seen a lot of 8s and 7s for this season so far. This is a jump up. So what made this a highlight for you for this season?
Well, for one thing, I think it's easily the best episode of the season so far. And it just took everything that I like about the show and everything that's sort of been building about the ongoing story arcs and the character development and whatnot, and it just made them all work and made them better than they have to date and made them all work together as this one cohesive story. They made good use of that plot device of let's sort of show roughly the same amount of time from a few different characters' perspectives. They did it to give, the different characters a chance to shine and do the kind of things that we know that they're good at, but also a chance to do something a bit out of the ordinary for them. Like, for example, the fact that it's Skye and Fitz and, to a lesser extent, Simmons, who are the ones sort of who have to be on the ground with the with their target when things go awry. The fact that I think... this episode, more so than any other, made me appreciate the fact that May is supposed to be one of the premier badasses in the Marvel Universe as far as S.H.I.E.L.D. agents and that go. As sort of like neatly proven just by that shot of like the body slumping down in front of her, and she's standing at the bottom of the ramp with blood on her face and just looking like, you know, death warmed up, and said, "Wheels up." That was a really good moment, and there were a lot of similar really good moments for all these different characters. More so than any other episode he's appeared in, I thought that Quinn was not a rubbish villain, and not a completely one-dimensional character, although he still has a ways to go. But making him sort of so beholden to the clairvoyant was a good place to take a character who had very little agency or characterization of his own. Even though I kind of knew where they were, that they were going to go the Deathlok route with Mike Peterson, the fact that it happened in this episode and the way it all went down was kind of dark and very tragic. There were so many little moments that I enjoyed because they were funny or they were exciting or just plain cool. And the end of the episode sets up the next the next episode and the ones after that to really follow through and play up on the two big aspects of the show's mythology, which is Coulson's resurrection and the question of who or what is Sky. Mm-hmm. It just all of the things that I've wanted the show to sort of do, it's doing. It's using the procedural formula rather than being beholden to it, and it's giving us really good character moments that develop them or give them a chance to shine or something, and it's developing the mythology and the story arcs. It's becoming a strong entity in its own right, and not just as a thing to watch on TV while we wait for the next Marvel movie to come out.
Hmm. Edmund, agrees, disagree? Anything?
Yeah, I guess the reason why I was dropping it down to an 8 was primarily I did like the back and forth structure, but there was something about it that felt a little clumsy. It was done reasonably well, but it just didn't feel quite as cohesive as it could have. But I agree in terms of the way they were setting things up, and certainly the whole idea of having Sky and Fitzsimmons being the ones driving it. Was a good twist and a good way to drive things forward. And at the same time, given the way it made sense that, of course, it winds up with Sky virtually dead. And I did like the way that they played that up, but at the same time, made it feel not it wasn't tacked on that, oh yes, and we happen to have this hyperbaric chamber that Mike Peterson just came in here to save her. It worked within the whole structure, and episode they'd set up. So I thought overall it was one of those things where I'm not sure I can put an exact sense on it, but it was well done, but it just felt like it was not quite there. They are definitely getting there, and it was a better than average episode. And I'm pretty sure this isn't what brought it down the full point, but I really do think Stan Lee needs to limit himself to Hitchcock type cameos. I'm sorry, somebody had.
But he's right. You always made more time for your prostitutes.
Fine, just throw it out there like that. But anyhow, it definitely. I that's why I was in between. I think that there was some kind of ephemeral something in the episode that wasn't quite hitting it for me in terms of just how it was gelling. I think that all the pieces were there. It was definitely hitting more of its potential than I think it has since, in a while. We've seen glimpses of it, but it now really feels like when they said they were kicking things up in the second half of the season that, yes, they were right. They're getting there. But I still feel like I'm waiting for something. Not nearly as much as some of the people who are poo-pooing this show have said in the past. I really don't think that this is as bad a show as some people say it is. But I do feel like it still hasn't quite hit its rhythm. And I still feel as though part of that is that it's trying to, there are certain milestones that it needs to reach, and it's trying to balance that with its own narrative. And I think definitely, Bronstam, you hit the nail on the head that Skye's journey and her and the revelations of what she is all about is now, that's now going to intersect rather naturally with finding out what really happened with Coulson, because now that he knows that there's something out there that was able to bring him back to life, we now have a situation where he not just wants to find out, but he needs to find out. And maybe even a little bit more about why it is that he feels so damn responsible for Skye in the first place.
Yeah, I had come to those conclusions on my own even before I saw what the title of the next episode is.
Yes. which since we do not spoil ahead of time, no, we will not mention.
Yeah, which is good, because I actually don't know what it is. So yeah. I've been trying not to spoil myself too much, although certainly ABC is doing everything in its power to spoil the living crap out of this show, but... anyway, all right, well, I think we're going to leave it there for now for this show. Guys, somebody give me a title for this one. I'm not sure what to call this.
Yeah, I got nothing.
That's not helping. All right, well, if we think about it.
No Babylon 5?
Sure.
No, that'll give the impression that we don't talk about Babylon 5 at all, and that would be incorrect.
No.
All right, we'll think of something. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...